And welcome to the eighth episode of this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and I'm here with my co-host, David Grigg. Hello, David.
Hi, Perry. How's things?
Pretty good, thanks very much. Pretty good. Everything's been fine. I'm just basically gearing up to heading off to Dublin in a couple of weeks.
Oh, lucky you.
Going over there for the World Science Fiction Convention for this year. So... as we have been talking, but the listener will probably not know, is that I'll be absent for a couple of episodes, but you'll be looking after things and holding the fort.
We'll soldier on. We'll soldier on.
I think you'll probably be able to get through it without my dulcet tones and my very, very light touch on this podcast, as you seem to be doing the bulk of the work. For which I'm eternally grateful. How shall we say that? Very, very, very grateful for the work that you're doing on this. So a couple of weeks I'll be off. We'll have a number of things pre-recorded, but we might have a couple of other little things that sort of pop up from over that period when I'm away. I think I'm actually going to be missing three episodes, which seems a bit strange, but it's just for a five-week period, it basically picks one at the beginning and one at the end. So 3 weeks all up, when I'm not going to be here.
You'll have a great time.
I'm hoping to do so. So time to move on with today's episode.
The Hugo Time Machine.
Today, we're going to be talking about the 1955 Hugo Awards. These are the awards that were given for works published during the calendar year of 1954. We're still in the early days of the Hugo Awards being handed out. The only awards that were given at that convention were for the novel, the novelette, and the short story. So only three, and unfortunately we don't seem to have much in the way of a shortlisted set of works. All we have is the winners from this particular year, which is a bit disappointing because it'd be nice to know what each of these awards were up against for reasons that will become incredibly obvious as we go through and talk about this. The first award we want to talk about is the novel, because that's the biggie, as George Martin calls it. So the award for Best Novel, 1955 Hugo's, was given to They'd Rather Be Right by Mark Clifton and Frank Riley.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you were going to be given a questionnaire to just about any science fiction fan in the universe, and one of the questions was, what is the worst novel ever to win the Hugo Award? The vast majority of people would basically choose They'd Rather Be Right by Clifton and Riley. And, dear listener, we're here to say, well, I'm here to say, that I've read this book so you don't have to.
Thank you, Perry.
It's terrible. It really is not very good at all. Published in 1954 between August and November in Astounding magazine, which was edited at the time by John W. Campbell Jr., who was probably the preeminent editor, magazine editor in the field at that time. You would have thought that he might have either requested the authors basically do a little bit more work on this particular novel, or just basically chucked it out because there's really not terribly much here. The novel starts really nowhere and doesn't progress anywhere at all. It just doesn't go anywhere. The characters are flat. There's a few ideas which aren't expanded on at all very, very well. And it's really not very good. From this particular point of view, what are we talking about, 65-odd years after it was first published, there's not much here to keep you interested. Basically, the novel deals with a artificial intelligent computer that has been developed by a couple of scientists, Basically, once everybody finds out about this particular computer and wants to get their hands on it, they decide to do a runner and take off with their assistant, secretary, Joe, and they go off and they basically hide off somewhere in a city. Now, it works out, or you find out, that Joe is telepathic. I couldn't for the life of me work out why in the area of the story, why Joe needed to be telepathic. There just seemed to be absolutely no reason for it at all, other than the fact that the authors basically wanted to wave their hands over a couple of things that Joe figures out, and the best way to do that was to by making him telepathic. Doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I know that Campbell was pretty keen on telepathy and psionics and all the rest of those particular areas because he felt that was the next area of evolution for mankind. And so you get the impression that the authors put this in purely as a teaser for Campbell. So he'd say, oh, this is a good novel. I'll take this. Well, it basically doesn't work. There's not really very much here at all that's going to keep you of interest. The one saving grace for the whole thing is that the novel is short. It's probably about 150 pages, and that's basically it. And you get to the end and you sort of think, well, thank God that's over. So it's really weird in the sense that if you go hunting around for 1954, you actually find out that there are a couple of other really, really good books that were published in that year in the science fiction field. A Mirror for Observers by Edgar Pangborn. I haven't read that for 30 or 40 years, but I do seem to recall it was a fantastically excellent novel. And Mission of Gravity by Hal Clement. Now, come on. How can you possibly choose this book that I'd rather be right over A Mission of Gravity? The Clement novel is not the greatest novel that you're ever going to read, but by God, it's a heck of a lot better than this one that we've been given. And at least it basically sets out an interesting topic and handles it pretty well. The Clifton and Riley novel, no. Don't bother. If you're ever given the opportunity to read it, pass on. There's a heck of a lot more that you can get to. Have you had the opportunity, David, to read this one?
Thankfully, I left it all to you, Perry. I was very happy that you were prepared to take a bullet for this and read this novel. So, no, I didn't read it.
The follow-up award in the 1955 Hugos was that for novelette. This is a novelette, which, as you will recall, that we spoke about episode or two back. Not quite as long as a short novel, longer than a short story. This is all really very weird because in the 1950s, the people running the Hugo Awards had not really finalised their word length. And so things were called novelettes if they were printed as a novelette. And that's really about all we had. So you had to basically deal with what you had. Walter M. Miller Jr. wrote a novelette called The Darth Stella. It was first published in Astounding in January 1955. So it probably was released in December 1954, which is why it was probably allowed to be nominated for the Hugo Awards for 1955. So although the magazine had a issue date of January 1955, it was published in 1954, and therefore it was allowed. Now, some people have said that this is a pretty good novelette. It's very dated. But it does actually give you the indication that Walter M. Miller Jr. was really quite a good writer. And when you compare this to the novel, it really stands out as being a far, far better written story than that was a novel. This particular story deals with the problems of robots taking over particular jobs. And in this case, what we're talking about is actors working in live theatre. Theoretically, what's happened is that the society has moved on from live theatre itself and from television, and now, for whatever reason, people like going along to the theatre, so they have to go out of their house and go to the theatre and watch a live performance of robots on stage going through a pre-prepared program that has been based on an original human's performance of a particular piece of work. So it has, the story has some interesting things to say about robots' work, creativity, the takeover of menial or not so menial jobs by robots from humans. And it deals with one particular character who's an actor working in a theatre, but he's only working there as a cleaner because he can't get a job anymore as being an actor, because all the actors' jobs have been taken by the robots, of course. And so it strikes me as being a classic Campbell astounding story. Very well written, worthwhile, certainly worthwhile reading. Would I say that it was one of the greatest novelettes ever written? No, not at all. It's very dated. There's a view there that when you look at it, you realise that it's a 1950s world plunked into somewhere in the future. We're not terribly sure how far in the future, but with the idea of these mannequins, robots that are taking over. It's interesting, worthwhile reading. The short story for the year is one by Eric Frank Russell called Alamagusa.
Now, I actually have read this one.
This is another classic Campbell style short story from Astounding, published in May of the year. It's basically the US Navy pushed forward sometime into the future, and reflected as a starship core somewhere up and up the line. Basically, it's this particular ship that we're dealing with in this instance has been swamped by bureaucratic paperwork. And I actually mean to point out that paperwork is the operative story here, because they are still dealing with paper. There isn't the ubiquitous computing that we might recognise as being the way that offices work now. This is purely a matter of they have to go through and tick everything off on paperwork. They have to basically eyeball everything in the ship. And really what it comes down to is that this particular ship is in dry dock and has been told that it is going to have a full inspection by the supplies directorate. This guy is going to turn up and he's going to go through from this starship from top to bottom to make sure that everything that should be there is there, and anything that shouldn't be there is not there. And of course, there's one particular thing which they cannot work out what it is, and they basically decide that they're going to build it and have it sitting around and then get it marked off, and then later on work out what they're going to do with it. It's just a classic Astounding story that Campbell would have loved. Eric Frank Russell used to write a lot of stories which were one-joke stories. He's most famous, I suppose, for his novel Wasp, which is really quite excellent. But you can read it with a bit of a jaundiced eye now, because it deals with a human who is placed on an alien world and is tasked with becoming a nuisance to everybody. Nuisance in those times, terrorist in our terms. And so you can look at it and be a little bit disappointed with the way that the story progresses. But in general, that gives you a really good idea about what Eric Frank Russell is like. And so does this particular story. It's a one-joke story, but it works and it does okay. And you can understand why the Hugo voters really went for it.
Wouldn't you say, though, that why is it science fiction? I mean, it's really just a Navy story set in space. That there's nothing in the story which really relates to the fact that there's any futuristic situation or anything unusual about the star travel. It's all just a bit of a Navy joke transferred into space, if you took the whole story and set it on board a Navy destroyer, it would work just as well. Wouldn't you say so?
Yes, it is. It's just really one. It's a one-joke story. And as I said, it basically takes the US Navy from the 1950s, plunks it up sometime into the future and says, okay, here's a Starship Corps. They're going to have exactly the same problems. They're going to deal with them in exactly the same way. But it's just a joke.
Yep.
That's all it is. It's a one joke story.
Yep.
But that's what Russell did. Works okay.
Yeah.
David, I know that we're science fiction fans at heart, but that's not the only thing we read. We also basically have our own little interests in other genres associated sometimes with science fiction, sometimes not. And you have been a bit of a fan of the works of Kate Atkinson for quite some time, I believe.
I certainly have. There are some authors whose work you like so much that when you hear about a new book by them, you have to rush out and buy it straight away, or if it's in advance of the publication, to put it on pre-order and eagerly read it as soon as it comes into your hands. And there are only a few such authors that fit in that category for me, and Kate Atkinson is definitely one of those for me. Kate Atkinson is an English novelist. She was born in the north of England the same year as I was. In fact, she's only a few months younger than I am, and that means that she's almost my exact contemporary. And she was born in York. I was born in Yorkshire, and even though I left England at the age of 13, there's a shared cultural background which resonates for me throughout her novels. Now, it doesn't mean you have to have that shared background, but it just adds a little extra to me. So, what kind of books does she write? Well, she doesn't write science fiction, and they vary. They all feature very strong and interesting characters, and they also have a delightful, ironic sort of humour, even though in them many sad and sometimes even tragic things occur in them. Now, in preparation for this podcast, I've been rereading those of her novels which feature a particular character called Jackson Brodie. There are now 5 of these books, and the latest one has just come out. The first couple of the books were used as the basis of a TV series by the BBC called Case Histories, but I haven't seen them, and I can't quite imagine how well they turn out, as so much of the delight of Atkinson's books is in her written style and the delightful touches of humour that she has. Anyway, I set out to do this, and I managed to reread the first 4 Jackson Brodie books over the last couple of weeks, but I ran out of time to finish the very latest, which is called Big Sky. Atkinson's novels definitely bear rereading, though, and I've really enjoyed going through the series once more. Now, as is true of all of her novels, the Jackson Brodie books don't really fit comfortably into any strict sort of genre, but you might think that given that the character Jackson Brodie is an ex-soldier and an ex-policeman, and that when we're first introduced to him, he's working as a private investigator. And so you immediately think we're going to put this in the slot of a murder mystery or a detective story. That would be quite a major mischaracterization, though. It's not really the thrust of the books. There are certainly mysteries in them, and certainly puzzles. There are even a few murders which happen in the books, but Brodie generally only has a small role in unravelling them. Rather, he seems to act as a catalyst who triggers events and he stirs up reactions in people which reveal more of the truth to the reader. But throughout, we're far more interested always in the cast of characters we're introduced to than in the solving of the particular puzzle or puzzles in the book. So I'll just briefly cover some of the books that I've been rereading in the series. The Jackson Brodie books start with Case Histories, which is what the BBC took the title of their series from. And Case Histories, as the title suggests, is based on 3 case histories which Brodie attempts to resolve. So these are the mysterious disappearance of a toddler 25 years ago, the senseless murder of a young woman on her first day working at her father's law firm, a request from someone to track down the whereabouts of the child of a woman who has been convicted and jailed for the murder of her husband. These cases appear at first to be completely unrelated, but then links begin to appear between them. In fact, one thing which is constant throughout these books is the way in which Atkinson weaves together these apparently disparate threads, which ultimately form a fantastic tapestry, a fantastic picture. Sometimes these links may stretch our belief in coincidence, and using coincidence in writing is generally a bit of a no-no for writers. But what I would say is that Atkinson seems to have elevated coincidence and unexpected cross-connections into something of an art form. The second book, based in Edinburgh during the Edinburgh Festival, is called One Good Turn, and begins with what seems to be a road rage incident. A car stops suddenly, and the car behind it runs into it. Nothing unusual about that, happens every day. But then a big burly guy climbs out of the car behind, carrying a baseball bat, and he starts savagely attacking the driver of the car in front. A passerby interrupts what seems to be likely to be a fatal confrontation. I mean, he picks up his bag, has got a laptop in it, and throws the bag at the guy with the bat, hits him in the head, sort of knocks him over a bit, and the guy then picks up his bat and runs away. So that's the one good turn of the title. Now, all of these three people, the driver of the first car, the person, the guy with the bat, the person who threw the laptop bag, and as well as Jackson Brodie, who was one of the eyewitnesses, and a couple of other eyewitnesses, all end up being connected together in a story of deceit, fraud, and murder. And yet, despite all that, I laughed out loud on finishing the book. The very last piece of the jigsaw puzzle fell into place, and several things suddenly became clear, including a better understanding of what was going on at the very start of the book. But it's the third book in the series which, to my way of thinking, is something of a masterpiece. It's called When Will There Be Good News? And it starts with a truly awful incident, a sudden murderous knife attack on a woman and her three young children, only one of whom escapes. This incident occurs 30 years before the main action of the book, which is also based in Edinburgh. We're introduced to Reggie, or Regina Chase, my favourite character in all of Atkinson's books so far. She's 16 years old, but looks much younger. She lives all by herself, ever since her mother died about a year previously. She's very smart and very determined. She's quit school, but is being tutored privately in literature by an ex-teacher. Her father died when her mother was 6 months pregnant, when he was killed during the Gulf War, shot by, quote, friendly fire. And Reggie says about this, "Most people were out of the womb before they first encountered irony." Reggie's employed as a full-time babysitter for Dr. Joanna Hunter, who we discover is the sole survivor of the massacre which starts the book. Dr. Hunter and her baby eventually go missing, but despite her frantic efforts, Reggie is unable to get the police to take her seriously when she reports this. Dr. Hunter's dodgy husband says that she's just off visiting a sick relative. Then there's a horrific train crash, and Reggie saves Jackson Brodie's life as he lies bleeding, thrown from the train. When she finds out that he's been a policeman and a private investigator, she forces him to help her find the missing mother and child, whose lives are seriously at threat. Does all this sound depressing? Maybe, but it's nevertheless frequently a very funny book. And there are again several apparently unconnected things which startlingly come together towards the end of the book. It's worth noting that throughout almost all of these books, there's a strong theme, an ongoing theme, about the love, sometimes the fanatical love, that parents have for their children. Brodie himself has a young daughter about whom he has very strong feelings and a burning desire to protect her, though he's separated from her mother. In Case Histories, we're introduced to Theo, the broken-hearted father of the young woman murdered at the law firm, and discover his obsession with trying to work out the reason for her death. In When Will There Be Good News, Dr. Joanna Hunter takes very drastic steps to save the life of her baby. And the fourth book, Started Early, Took My Dog, is really all about displaced and missing children and one woman's acquisition of a child which isn't hers. The other thing to note about Atkinson's books is that they're all full of delightful literary allusions. In When Will There Be Good News, we get a lot of references to the Roman classics, courtesy of the fact that Reggie is learning Latin, among other subjects. And from Brodie's point of view, we get many references to the Like, Wake, Dirge, which I remember having to memorise at school, as did Jackson Brodie. In the fourth book, Started Early Took My Dog, we have many references to both Shakespeare and the poetry of Emily Dickinson. None of these references get in the way if you don't recognise them, but it's delightful when you do. Atkinson's other novels are quite different to the Jackson Brodie books, but they're all of equally high quality and interest, and they're all well worth reading. I might mention in particular one of them, which is Life After Life. At the very start of this book, on the first page, the main character Ursula dies as a baby in the process of being born, with the umbilical cord round her neck. Then she dies again and again, several times, in different ways, before we're 10 pages more into the book. So a series of parallel lives open up, exploring different ways Ursula's life might have gone, and exploring different timelines in the first half of the 20th century leading up to the Second World War. Atkinson's treatment of the Blitz in London is much more clear-sighted and grim than that given by, say, Connie Willis in her Blackout or Clear books. So I've probably talked for far too long, but just let me commend Kate Atkinson's books to you, and I encourage you to read them. I don't think you'll be disappointed. Now, Perry, you're very keen on another writer, John le Carré, I understand, and you've been rereading his books, but not, I presume, his entire output.
No, David, I think he's basically up to around about 20, 25 novels by now. I'm a fair way behind, but he's one of those ones that I've neglected. And so I just thought that it was probably about time that I started to get back into him again, given that he keeps on publishing just about every year. If you don't do it, you don't keep up. I'm basically looking at the Quest for Carla novels. These are the books that a lot of people will know and probably know le Carré best for. Though there's three of them. Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which came out in 1974. The Honourable Schoolboy in 1977. And Smiley's People in 1979. Now, some people will know of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy either from the TV series, which was produced in 1979, with Alec Guinness as George Smiley, the main character, or from the film that was produced, I didn't realise it was this long ago, in 2011, with Gary Oldman in the main role. And there was also a TV series based on Smiley's People, made in 1982. There's a rumour that the BBC, or whoever it was in Britain that was actually working on the two other series, had decided that they were originally intending to do The Honourable Schoolboy, but because it is based mostly in Southeast Asia, they decided that it was probably going to be too expensive, so they gave it the flick and didn't get to it. Probably, in retrospect, not a bad idea, but I'll get to that in just a minute. Now, the interesting thing about this particular series is that there's been a follow-up novel published a couple of years ago called The Legacy of Spies, but it's also related to a book, probably the breakout book for le Carré, published in 1963, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and I'll explain why more later. George Smiley does get a walk-on part at the end in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, but it's only a very small part. But this really set le Carré on his way. He became very well known after this because it's really quite an excellent book. And in any way you look at it, it's probably one of the greatest spy novels written in the 20th century. A lot of people will understand that it was written in the early 60s, published in 1963, basically deals with the Cold War, Britain and West Germany and East Germany. You may have seen the film that was made sometime later starring Richard Burton. Fantastic part, fantastic role. He did really, really well in it. But that book really set le Carré on his way. He became well known. He had been working for the British intelligence, but he probably gave it up after that, more out of a point of probably being told that he couldn't do the two together. because I think probably British intelligence were probably thinking that he might start giving away some of MI5 or MI6's secrets, and they didn't really want him to do that. So anyway, he took up the role of being a major novelist. Did a few books between The Spy Who Came In from the Cold. Oh, and I also should mention that that was actually his third novel. The first two featured George Smiley, but they are, in my view, minor detective novels. I'll get back to them at some point in my reading history coming, in my reading time coming up in the next couple of decades, but I seem to recall they weren't all that flash when I read them last time. So I'm not really looking forward to going back to them again. But they do set up George Smiley as being the character that he is. And George really comes of age in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. This novel, if you haven't either seen the TV series or the film, is based around the search for a mole that has been discovered inside British intelligence, inside the circus, as it's called. The mole has been placed there by Russian intelligence. They don't know who it is, but they believe that the person that's been picked out has been in British intelligence for quite some years, some 20, if not 30 years, almost since the Second World War. This was coming in after the back of all the Philby and the Cambridge Five. So there was a long history of moles inside the public service, but also inside British intelligence. And so Le Carre hit on a really interesting topic for his particular book. The main character, George Smiley, has been pensioned off, basically. He's been pushed off to one side by the powers that be. He's brought back into the edges of the organisation. He's not brought back into the organisation itself because the minister wants to keep him completely separate because he doesn't want Smiley to be tainted by the mole. He wants him to undertake an investigation completely separately from the whole affair and work out who it is that is there. Mostly people are considering that it is somebody very high up in the organisation, and George Smiley has a history with all of them, and so there's a little bit of to-ing and fro-ing there as well about whether George is going to be able to do this in an unbiased way. At the same time as all this is going on, George's marriage to Anne is slowly breaking down. He's rather monogamous, she's rather promiscuous, and has had a number of affairs over the years to which he's turned a blind eye. But she now seems to be enamoured of one Bill Hayden, an ex-colleague of George's from British intelligence, and actually one of those that's under suspicion right from the very beginning. Now, I won't tell you what happens in all this, but I really suspect that everybody probably knows, but what the heck. I think if you haven't read it, you really should. I think it's one of the great novels of the second half of the 20th century that I've read in particular. I can't speak for all the others, of course, but only those that I have read. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful book. It deals with human failings at an absolute base level. It deals with desire, betrayal, deceit, corruption, loyalty, right down to the nitty-gritty of it all. And it's as much a book about a failing marriage as it is about the mole and British intelligence. In the end, Smiley does find out who the mole is and everything gets cleaned up, and the old leaders of British intelligence get shown the door, and George basically moves in and takes over. The second book, An Honourable Schoolboy, is nowhere near as good as the first. Half of it is set in Southeast Asia, and it deals with Smiley's continuing search for Carla. Carla is the head of Moscow Central. He was the one that set up the whole process of putting the mole into British intelligence that we dealt with in the first of these books. And at one stage in the first book, Smiley actually talks to Gwilym, who's his offsider that's been seconded from the British intelligence to help him out with the investigation, and says to him that he met Carla once, back at a time after the Second World War, when Joe Starlin was in one of his paranoid phases, and he ordered all intelligence agents that were living overseas, that's overseas from Russia, back to Moscow for interrogation. British intelligence was trying to intercept as many of these agents as they could on the way back to Moscow to try to convince them that it was probably a far better idea that they actually came over to Britain rather than going back to Moscow, where there was a fairly good chance that they were going to get shot. And a lot of them did. Smiley met up with Carla in New Delhi, as Carla was on his way back to Moscow from somewhere in Southeast Asia, and interrogated him for a while, spoke to him. Carla doesn't say a thing throughout the whole of the meeting. But as he, Carla, is about to leave, he reaches over and grabs Smiley's cigarette lighter, a cigarette lighter that has got an inscription on it, which reads something along the lines of, "To Darling George from Anne," Anne being his wife. Carla hangs on to this cigarette lighter all the way through, right through until the end of the third book. Anyway, so Carla goes back to Moscow and seems to survive. He seems to keep on flourishing when all around him are dying left, right and centre. So he, Carla, ends up moving up to the top of Moscow intelligence, Moscow Central. And in the second book, he set up a money laundering facility somewhere down in Southeast Asia and trying to work money through from China and a lot of Russian satellites up through, back up into Russia again. And he's also using the money going backwards and forwards to pay for agents in the various parts of Asia, including China, Hong Kong, which of course was still under British control at that time, Cambodia, Vietnam, Malaysia, and all the others. Basically, Smiley in the end figures out what's going on, sets a trap, basically closes down the money laundering facility, but wangles it so that the Americans end up getting all the credit. Gillam later on actually muses that this was done so that Smiley could basically say, oh, well, I messed it up. The CIA got all the credit for it, and therefore Smiley would be asked to leave the British intelligence, which he does, and he does get asked to do that, and so he goes off to retirement once again. Smiley's People starts, and it's a bit of a reflection about what happens in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, in that an old operative of Smiley's from Estonia hears something that might be to the interest of George Smiley and tries to get a hold of him. But prior to being able to talk to Smiley about what he knows, he's murdered. Smiley is again brought in by the minister to check and see what's happening, because there's a rumour that this bloke who died actually knew something really, really important. And as it happens, it's all to do with Carla and Carla's estranged mistress and estranged daughter, who has been sent to France for treatment for a medical mental condition. And George Smiley and his offsiders are able to determine that it is Carla that is actually involved with all this, and finally are able to put a lot of pressure on Carla so that he actually decides that the best thing for him to do is to defect. And he comes across at a major stopping point or a checkpoint in East Berlin. So he crosses over probably at one crossing that was very similar to the crossing that was first used in The Spy That Came In From the Cold. So I can see there's a synergy here. In The Spy That Came In From the Cold, the bloke coming over from East Germany into West doesn't make it and is shot. But Carla just strolls across, takes his time, stops and lights a cigarette in the middle of the bridge, and then walks over and hands himself over to British intelligence. When they go to handcuff him, he drops his cigarette lighter, and George sees that it's the lighter that he had stolen from him some 30-odd years before, and he just stares at it and walks off. This is an excellent series of books. It's a classic trilogy in style, in the sense that it is a really great first novel, absolutely tremendous first novel. The second one is so-so, not quite as good as the first, and it's really almost there to carry you through to the final part of The Quest for Carla, the third book, Smiley's People. I'd highly recommend it. I think it's a brilliant piece of work, and I think that it is really worthwhile having a read of. Even if you are a science fiction fan, there is some good stuff out there otherwise.
Don't forget to visit our website, twochairs.website, for more information and links to some of the books and movies we've been talking about.